Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles.
We are now dealing again with the David-Jacob connection, right? And again, just to remind you, this is not my invent. I mean, when I started to see these things, I had no idea the degree to which there was a history of literature on it, you know, by serious Bible scholars. So over time, as I've taught this, I have unearthed more and more things. And so it has been a serious endeavor. But as I say, there's stuff here that I found that others had not. And at some point, if I, you know, a project would be literally to pull together all of this stuff in one place and to really create a bibliography on it and, you know, note the various suggestions. And yeah, I can put in comments and whatever, you know, but it would be, but it's really very interesting. So one of the things we're going to be looking at today. Yes, we're moving on. This is going to be, I'm not going to ask you to flip through the Bible, but remember, I do hope you've marked your Jacob place and your David place just to facilitate our turning the pages, because I know Tybel has, she's given me her thumbs up. That Tybel, as long as it's the thumb, that's good. The thumb is good. Yes. Anyway. So another common feature is that both of them had trafim.
Trafim.
Yeah, household idols. Right? So tell me, where do Rachel's household?
Well, she sat on them.
Huh? She sat on them, right. Remember?
They were an inheritance. They were her Yerusha from her father.
Yeah, well, Laban is now rummaging. She took his trophy, right, when they left. When Jacob and his family moved out, before Laban knew about it, she took his trophim, because she figured if she took his trophim, he couldn't consult them to find out where they were. However, the word got out, but it was delayed, and it gave them an opportunity to get a head start. Of course, eventually he caught up, because they were moving with the Ganza Mishpocha and all the sheep, whereas he was just coming on his donkeys or camels or whatever, and, you know, they could go full speed, nothing would impede them, so they caught up with him. Anyhow, so he's rummaging around, he's really angry, not only that they left, but now because somebody took his idols. And, you know, so Jacob says, you know what, as far as I'm concerned, he had no idea that Rachel had done it, right? And so he says, go ahead, look. And he says, you know, and Laban said, I'll kill the guy. And Jacob says, I'll be gesund, assuming they're not there. So Rachel had them. He comes into Rachel's tent to check out. All right. And what does she do with her with his trophim? She had them. You remember? Anybody remember what she did with them? Tybel?
Is this the thing that's maybe sitting on, maybe I should speak as the only woman in the room. She hid them in a way that men don't go near women who are menstruating.
She sat on them.
Yeah.
She sat on them, right? She put a pillow down and sat on them.
Yeah, Bert said that already, actually, give credit to Bert.
Yeah, Bert, did we talk about this last time?
A few minutes ago.
Oh, no, but I mean, we didn't discuss specifically what I'm saying now. All right.
Right.
Point is, she sat on them while she was, and she said, I'm menstruating. So that meant to Laban, hands off. Right. That's, you know, that's whether it is seen, if he considered it to be a source of impurity or it was just something that men go, ugh, that's women's stuff, I don't want to touch it. And he left, okay? So she feigns a kind of physical situation, right? Fakes it, and, you know, gets everybody off the hook, all right? Now, Rachel, that's Rachel. Now let's talk about Michal. All right. What is her interest in Trofim? Bible.
If I recall, didn't she use one to make a fake David to fool the people looking for David after he jumped out of the window?
Well, before he jumped out of the... Yes, that's right. After he left. Yeah, exactly. So, once again, Saul is in a bipolar negative side, and he wants to kill his son-in-law. And so he sends guys over to take him and bring him over to the royal palace so he can get the deed done. And Michal, who always has her ear to the ground, heard out about it. You know, as they say, we have our ways. And she took the household trophim and put them in David's bed and actually put some animal stuff at the top so it looked like his hair, right? And covered it over. And she, when these guys came to take him, she said, shh, quiet, he's sick, he's sick. Go back, go away, go away. Wait till he, come back when he's better. He's sick, you don't want to be near him. And so they leave. She saved his life. He, in the meantime, had escaped. So this gave him, you know, a way out. Anyhow, yes. And so notice the commonality here is, number one, the use of trophim. Number two, the reference to illness of some kind, some bodily ailment. Yes. David presumably was supposed to be sick. Yes. And it's a fake. And Rachel was supposed to be menstruating. And that was a fake. So these two ruses are uses to save the man's life in both instances.
Okay. Oh, okay.
All right. So, I mean, and that's so Yair Zakovich mentions that he thinks that the details of the Michal story were based on the tradition with regard to that, the stories that had been floating around, whether they were written down or not, we don't know. But the idea that the account of Rachel was known, and the details surrounding how Michal saved David's life were sort of massaged to create that same situation. And to show once again that what happened in David's life was similar to what happened to Jacob's life. And so it is, all right? A leader can be a guy with a mixed record.
But it's interesting that Yaakov becomes Yisrael.
Yeah.
And David is Melech Yisrael.
Yes.
I mean,
we're going to get to that, actually, okay. in a slightly different way. Not identical. Hold that thought. Seriously. Oh, I'll say it right now. There are only another common denominator is we know from many other sources, extra biblical sources, archaeologically, that the Davidic dynasty was called Beit David. Right? And Beit Yaakov, very common in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So Jacob, B'nai Yisrael. I mean, there's only one other person whose name is associated
really?
With the group.
I think it's Ephraim. I think the rabbis sometimes talk about B'nai Ephraim.
No, Beit Ephraim doesn't exist. Or B'nai Ephraim. No.
B'nai Ephraim. Okay, never mind.
Or Beit Ephraim. You don't have it. Ephraim as a country Yes. It's Israel and Ephraim. Israel, I'm sorry. The northern kingdom is either called Israel or Ephraim. Haben Yakirli Ephraim. That's Jeremiah saying that, but he's meaning that Jeremiah loves the northern kingdom, looks forward to a day when the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. All right. But, so.
Who's the other Beit?
Aharon.
Ah, Beit Aharon.
Yeah. Beit Aharon. Yeah.
Which would make sense because it's the priesthood.
Exactly.
It's the
priesthood. But the one, of course, that is most commonly used is Beit Yaakov or Bnei Israel. Right. I mean, Jacob's patronymic use for the nation is much more widespread, but you have it with David. Okay, so what you said, Bert, about, Melech Yisrael and Yisrael is close.
Yeah.
Close. I'll give
If I were the king of Israel and I wanted to establish my bona fides, as it were, I would want to connect it to the original Yisrael.
Exactly. Yes, so you take use the same. But the concept of the household of, that's not so surprising, just in general use. But yes, that's exactly the point. So, I mean, it's not, as I said at the outset, it's not clear. We'll talk more about this toward the end. But, what came first, the chicken or the egg? I have my own thought about it, but we'll wait and see on that. Tybel.
Given rabbis in rabbinic literature, I know more about rabbinic than I do about Tanakh. Who is Beit Aharon, if you know, somewhere in Tanakh?
I'm only talking Bible.
And do you know where it is? I want to go look for it. Is it Torah or is it later?
Because
I don't have a concordance at hand.
No, I don't have a listing here. Where did I go to find it?
Concordance.
Exactly. Okay, and I have numbers. Hold on. To show you I'm totally crazy. Here. All right, so. Beit David is mentioned. Hold on. This 28 times, Beit Yaakov is 20 times, Beit Yisrael is 144 times, and Bnei Yisrael is over 500 times, and Bnei Aharon is 33, and Beit Aharon is 3. So that's the numbers. Okay. So, yes, Aharon in that context is understandable because it's the priesthood. All right. So, but there again, so this is another kind of a connector. Those are the only three. Obviously, there's no such thing as Beit Moshe, because he had no heirs that we know of, right? And as far as I know, that's it. All right. Moving along. So both have a son who tries to supplant his father as the alpha male in the household by having sex with a concubine or concubines while the father is still alive. Okay. Both have sons who try to supplant the father from his alpha male position by having sex with a concubine. Or let's say to have an impact on that. Let's use that term. In a sense, both are supplanting. Yeah, both are. Anybody have any thoughts?
Was that Absalom when he rebelled?
Yes, stop. Yes. Absalom. after he kicks David out of Jerusalem, or David runs away because he's got a rebellion on his hands for which he was not prepared. Sounds like the Israeli government we know and love today. Anyway, and so he runs away. As soon as he leaves town, Absalom takes all of David's concubines, takes them up to the roof of the palace so they're in view of everybody, and has sex with them. As a sign, I'm the alpha male man.
Gavolt.
That's what it says. And who did that? All right, so Tybel, you got the other one?
Well, Reuven, but what I was going to say about Absalom is, because, you know, I always think about the meanings of the names, the irony of Absalom, father of peace or completeness, then,
yes.
You know, it's just, yeah. I think it's an irony. And in particular, given Absalom, to me, is incidental in some ways, is not a main figure. So, sounding as it's fiction with an author picking names. I just think that I'll call the redactor maybe pick that name of a son, even if they didn't know which son did it, to make a point. Not a,
look, and he calls another son Shlomo, same Shalom, right? Shalem. So clearly those are names that are common. You know, so I don't know if this is something that was crafted. My guess is that's too big a thing. When somebody rebels, you know, and they have a whole account of it, I would accept the historicity of that. I definitely would. And I would think that probably was his name. But you mentioned the other one, which is Reuven. Right now, so those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, if you will please open your Bibles to Genesis 35:22, because I think Absalom's one clearly is more well known. But Genesis 35:22, what does it say?
It says, while Israel stayed in that land, Reuven went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel found out.
Exactly.
Da, 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 da.
Right.
And may I add something?
Wait, no. One second. I have a follow-up on that. Just a moment, please. Rock Rega, I want you now to turn to chapter 49 of the book of Genesis. All right, verses 3 and 4 with a focus on 4. You see it? Verse 4. He did it. And so he is basically cursed, right? And that's why, as we talked about once before, eventually the tribe of Reuven was just absorbed into the other tribes. And for all intents and purposes, as time went along, they just were lost. And the firstborn status just dissipated. So it's very possible, you know, that this chapter was written at a point where these things had already played themselves out. And this was a means of explaining why it was that Reuven, you know, and the same thing affected Shimon. We did talk about this.
Yeah, a lot of firstborns were...
Well, exactly. Well, that's standard. In the Bible, that seems to be standard operating procedure.
And now, this was just Jacob's deathbed where he was talking to all of his...
Yeah, exactly.
That's what this is. The final blessing.
We mentioned last time that there were only three people who had deathbed statements, right? And one of them was not to his children. Moses, basically. You know, not his deathbed, but in his last year. He does the same, you know, he lays out his blessings and so forth. But David and Jacob say what they need to say to their offspring.
Interesting that when it says Reuven lay with the concubine, there was no reaction whatsoever
at
that point. It waits to this point.
No, but the thing, I see your hand, Tybel, just wait a second. The thing is, when what Reuben did, I think we talked about this, what Reuben did by lying with Bilhah, who was Rachel's concubine, right? Laban gave Rachel Bilhah.
No, Leah's.
Leah Zilpah.
No, Leah's. That's what I was going to say. Because right, it's more.
What he did was basically by lying with her, he removed her from the possibility of becoming the number one female, the alpha female, taking Rachel's place. Because from what we know from other ancient Near Eastern law codes, that could be done. And so this is actually something that is based on ancient Near Eastern culture. And that's what's reflected there. And that's why he said, remember, when it happened, Jacob didn't do anything. It comes out when he dies. He says, you got into my bed when you shouldn't have. And that's a total disgrace of your father. What you could call, pardon me, this sounds a little bit off color, premature evacuation.
Oh, God.
Taking his father out of bed early. All right? I think that's pretty good, actually. Okay. So you put me in the same category as the Robertson I spoke to earlier, Tybel. All right, anyway, so... This is what's going on here. All right. And so the point is, apparently this is not which of the two accounts is the original? Okay.
Well, it's clearly an archetype, isn't it? It goes
back
to the Torah.
Yeah, it is. Here it becomes a kind of an archetype. Yeah. But I don't know. Okay. Bible.
Yes, sorry. First, I remembered wrong. I thought it was Leah's, but it's a better point, Rachel. So, mea culpa on that. But what I wanted to add about, the two verses you just had us do at the end is people see it's not just a deathbed confession in the first, but people see this as the model for Jewish wisdom literature that's ethical wills, that this in a way is the first ethical will, that there were intimations of what Yaakov valued, even as he said to his sons, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. So you could flip the reverse, because most of it really is, or a lot of it is negative, in some ways a terrible thing to leave your progeny with is your last message. So it often gets flipped in ethical will literature to say, regardless of what's said to this son, this is the opposite. What you should be doing is a value that Yaakov wanted to pass on.
Right, exactly. Yeah, good. Very good. Yeah, Mark.
I don't think there were procedures for abortion back in biblical days, but I know women miscarried. And this is sort of like a sign of miscarriage of justice. But, you know, it's like an abortion in its own way to put a curse on a firstborn.
In a sense. Yeah, in a sense. Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, look. Yeah. But yeah, it's very, it could be. I mean, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing to do with there was no miscarriage here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a miscarriage of justice or discipline or whatever. Yes. Or an abuse of.
But words had physicality in the Torah and the Bible. And to put a curse on a son or anybody had a powerful.
Yes, of course. The best example of that is, you know, with Jacob and Esau, when Esau comes and says, can you give me that blessing? Can you give me a blessing, that blessing too? He says, no, Jacob says, I can't. I only had one and it's out there. And I can't recall it. I can't negate it. The idea was that the power of a parent's blessing, as is the case here, this whole point is getting to the point of all this, Shimon Levi and Yehuda ultimately are not part of the land, end up after a few centuries not being part of the division of land in the country. Reuben and Shimon again dissipate eventually. And Levi, of course, doesn't have, they own some cities, the Levitical cities, but they don't have large estates because they're basically temple-based. Okay, so they don't need land. And then it's ironic that in the case of Levi, as you see in this chapter, if you read on, that's part of the curse, you know? And it, I mean, it's strange because you'd think that that's a kind of an elevation to work in the temple, right? To work in the Mishkan. That's a great honor. Okay. But at point, it appears at certain points, actually, that the Levites, probably more so in First Temple times, were in many ways just reduced to the level of temple slaves. The Kohanim could be very overbearing on them and say, you guys are the schleppers. I mean, they did. They are the schleppers as they move later on for the Mishkan, right? They carry, they assemble, disassemble, and carry the Mishkan. And that's a schlep. But it could be a sign of this kind of, we assume Levi is a big thing. We hear of the Levitical choirs, right? And, you know, B'nai Korach, which we, you know, we talked about in the Psalms class. So, I mean, there's all kinds of things regarding the priests, but there seems at certain points that that was not such a big honor. Yeah, Mark.
I think they had to wash feet too, if I recall, for the
high priest. That they do today. They still do that.
Still do that?
Sure, when you're duchen.
Uh-huh, they wash the feet.
No, they don't wash your feet. They wash your hands.
Okay. But, you know, it's, a,
no,
it's
no, another... No, 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 no. Well, yeah, I mean, it used to be something like that, but today it's just the hands. But there again, look at the imagery, right? The Kohen stands there, and the Levi takes the water and pours it on his hands. Who's the boss and who's the servant?
And to be rendered landless, it's another archetype for the Jewish people. I mean, Jews could not own land in Eastern Europe and other places. Well, they were reduced.
Yeah, you're right. It's ironic, yes. Yeah, it is. Tybel.
So, sorry, since there are only, you know, three students. I am Tybel because I was named after my great-grandmother was born Tybel Rachman, and she married a Siegel. You know, Siegel is an acronym for a Levite. So I have, she had this great name, Dove, Compassion, Assistant to the Kohanim. Anyway, I just thought I'd toss that out there for the recording, though, Bert, you can take it out.
I'm not going to. I don't think we do not pay Bert enough to have him edit texts. So don't worry. It'll go down in perpetuity. All right. Moving on. Ah, yes. Now we have something very interesting. Both have in their family a young woman named Tamar who gets into a sexually complicated matter with one of their sons, right? Okay, so Tamar gets into a sexually complicated matter with Judah, right? She plays the part, the prostitute, seduces him into having sex, and then he finds out she gives birth, and he comes yelling and running at her because she was already promised to Shelah, his youngest, Judah's youngest son, because he writes by Levirate rules, and she's not allowed to do that, so she is subject to death penalty. So he says, kill her. And they find, just a second, they find her and she says, I left my two items as a security with the guy with whom I slept. They were this ring, a signet, and a staff. No, he left it with me. because he promised me a sheep. Right? He promised me a sheep. The guy who slept with me promised me a sheep. And as collateral, that's what he did. So Jacob says, Judah says, oh my God, it's me. You. Oh. And she explains why. He was required to give her his third son, Shelah, as a husband to perpetuate the line of Er, the firstborn, to whom she was married. That's the role of the brother-in-law. Okay? And Jacob held him back. Judah held him back because he was afraid the first two died. Maybe there's a curse here. Let's see what seems to be going on, right? And in the end, what does he say? What does Judah say to Tamar? In the end, he says,
you were right.
Tzadakt. Exactly. You're right. I'm wrong. So that ended up good, right? That ended up good because, and so I think I mentioned once before, I don't know if it was in this class or the other class, that, excuse me, it's very likely to contemporary scholars suggest that there may have been in the early days of the development of the Levirate concept, the notion that the father-in-law, if the boys couldn't do it, the father-in-law could step in. But nobody knows that for sure. But in any case, she is cleared of any guilt here. And in fact, right, when we talked about I think we talked about this in the context of the Book of Ruth, right? She's her kids, parents, right? They had twins. We'll talk about that in a minute. Twins were born. Parents was one of them. Parents is the beginning of the line
of David.
That ultimately ends up with Boaz, who marries Ruth, and they end up, that line continues to David. So that's another one of the connectors, right? Right? So anyhow, so that's with that one. And the other one, of course, is, and I'm not going to have you read it because these cover it's a lot of material, is Amnon and Tamar, right? So Tamar is the daughter of David, right? No. His son Amnon, no, sorry, his son, right, his son Amnon, her stepbrother, rapes her.
Wait, aren't they halves, not steps?
Yeah, half, right, that's what, I'm sorry, yes, half, thank you, right. They're half, right, because David is the father of both. Different wives. So Amnon rapes Amnon. Avshalom is her full brother. Amnon is her half brother. Amnon rapes her. Okay, and ultimately, he gets killed. Absalom sees to his murder. Okay, so the point is, they're both named Tamar, and they both have relations that are controversial. In the one instance, the first Tamar plotted it out herself. In the second one, the other Tamar was raped. The full meaning, full meaning of this. In fact, he says, the first thing she says to him is, marry me. That way you can have sex with me and it'll be kosher. Right? He's not, since they're not blood relatives, they can be married. He refuses because he don't want to have anything to do with it. He just wants. He just wants to relieve himself, and she was a pretty lady. Because afterward, he doesn't go near her again.
Did the second Tamar have a child? Did she get pregnant from the rape?
No.
Okay.
Not
so
that
that's
I'm
a
not.
Difference.
I don't think so.
Yeah, no.
I don't think so. No. Yeah, that's a big difference. Because the first one was kosher. The second one was a rape. Okay. Anyhow, but the other thing, of course, that's interesting is that, no, that's a, well, that's another one. While we're talking about these Tamars, this Tamar, what did she wear? We talked about this last time, remember? What did she wear?
That was it?
A what?
Yeah, there was a Hebrew term you used.
Yeah, Ketonet Pasim. She wore an ornamented a coat. And who else wore a ketonet
pasim? Sounds familiar, Joseph.
Joseph, exactly. So both Jacob and David had a child who wore that, and that became at issue. It's mentioned in the context of horrible events, right? Because after she was raped, Tamar takes that and she soils it and tears it, so to speak, because it's almost like she's using that to sit Shiva. And because, you know, her status was diminished. And by the way, from that point on, she lives in Absalom's house and we don't hear anything of her. He felt to protect her, but she became out of circulation, apparently. Whereas, of course, in the case of Jacob, he sees that as part of the trick to get him to believe that Joseph was dead. Right? It's payback, so to speak. So these are this whole thing, the Tamar cloak, right? And Tamar in the other direction, a sexual act that has controversy associated with it. You can see that there is a clear, and by the way, remember what I said last time, the ketonet pasim is mentioned only that, the ketonet is mentioned elsewhere, pasim is mentioned elsewhere, but that phrase of the two of them together is only found five times in the whole Bible, three times with respect to Joseph, and twice with respect to Tamar, David's Tamar, and both within those, you know, narrow contexts. That's it. Okay? Okay. Tybel.
Two things. One is I just wanted to say about the second Tamar. I think there's another reading, not that Avshalom was overcome with sexual desire, but that he used rape as a tool of domination because Tamar was not, whatever, sufficiently subservient to him, sufficiently whatever.
You mean Amnon, not Avshalom.
I'm sorry. Amnon. I said the wrong brother.
Right.
Amnon, sufficiently.
She didn't fight him, right?
But isn't there a sense, I didn't look, that she was walking around as if she had the right to walk around, and which is how we noticed her?
No, that's what's her name? That's Jacob's daughter.
Dina,
she went out.
Yeah, I'm now going to look, but the other is, I apologize.
She was walking around.
I missed which phrase is only five times.
Huh? No, that's Tamar. That's David's Tamar. I'm not sure. I don't say there's no indication that she flaunted it. It just said that she wore.
I think it's Midrash. You know, I know more rabbinic. I think it's Midrash. But anyway, I'll look later. But which specific phrase in the Hebrew is five times?
No, the ketonet pasim.
Oh, the robe, the ornamental.
Only
robe.
In those two stories.
Got it. Okay.
Jacob and Joseph and the sons, and it all deals with the family, with the kids. right? Deals all this is associated with the children. So anyhow, the Midrash makes a deal, big deal, that says that Dina went out to see what was going on in the town. And therefore, there are some rabbinic sources that suggest that she was responsible for her rape, because she, had she stayed home like she should have, it never would have happened.
Yeah, anyway, I just say, but aren't those the same strain of rabbinic sources that say a really pious woman keeps her head covered even in her house and looks back at the woman who had, what, 7 sons that were high priests? So, but I think it's a different rabbinic midrash earlier that talked about Tamar, but I don't remember.
Find out where somebody blames, I'm using that word consciously, blames Tamar for her rape. Let me know, because it's a very common thing for men to say, you know, unfortunately. You know about that. I'd like to see that midrash if you can find it. All right. Now, names. 1 second. Okay, we talked about that. I'm going through my list here. Right. Let's talk about names. This is a very interesting thing. And I may be a little cuckoo on this, but I will show it to you. So we have instances in both families, obviously, where we have problems among siblings. We have issues. We have, in the case of Judah, we have children dying. In the case of David, we have a child dying, all of which are in the context of improper sexual acts, okay, or the lack thereof. In these cases, yeah. Okay, where something went wrong with this, with the relationships. So first of all, Er, Ayin Resh, is the name of Judah's first son. Okay, this is the lead up to the Tamar thing. All right? So Er married Tamar. Er got sick and died because he did something bad. Something ra in God's eyes. That's what it says. Okay. So then Onan, the second son, is called forward. And he has sex. But what does he do at the last minute? He pulls out and spills his seed. And for that, that also was a bad thing. And both of these were bad in God's eyes. Okay? And then you have a guy called, and then Shelah, of course, is Judah's third son, who was supposed to marry Tamar, but never did. Okay? All right, so these are all mixed up stuff. But it's interesting is all of these names have some, and these instances have some interesting resonance in the David stories. So, for example, Er and what Er and Onan do is something that is, that was seen to be evil in God's eyes. So here, look. Look at the name Er.
That's backwards for Ra.
Interesting, huh? Now, look at the name Onan, who also did something Ra in God's eyes. Look at the names. What's the difference in the names?
A mem.
Mem. Okay? Isn't that interesting? And so found evil in God's eyes. All of this. Not particularly in, with regard to Amnon, it doesn't say that. But let's talk about David for a moment. He was not too moral a guy as king, was he? What does he do with Bathsheba?
He arranges for her husband to be killed in battle.
He seduces her. Huh. He has sex with her, right? Okay. Then he realizes, I see your hand, Tybal. He realizes that, and she becomes pregnant. So he calls her husband, Uriah, who was out fighting, calls him back from the battle lines and tries to get him to have sex with his wife, right? Because he's her husband, Uriah, yes? So she, basically, he committed adultery. All right, but nobody would know about that, except for the fact that she became pregnant with his child. So he brings Uriah in soon thereafter, tries to induce him to have sex with her, so everybody could say, oh, look, Uriah came back from the front and had sex with his wife, and they have a baby, Mazel Tov. And then there would be no blame pointed at the king. Okay? But Uriah refuses to lie with her. He says, no, I got to go back to the front because my comrades are out there getting schmeissed. They need all the help they can get. I got to go back. And he refuses to lie with his wife.
I'm sorry, but this sounds like a bad TV soap opera.
Now, hold on, I'm not finished. But then, so David says, okay, I'm going to send you back. And he sends him back with orders. Put him in the front line in the hopes that he would get killed. And he did. So David commits two crimes, adultery and murder. Nathan the prophet calls him on that. And he says in both instances, what term is used? Ra. And then and that same word, of course it is, because they're two evil things. Okay? And it says it was seen as being evil in God's eyes. The same term exactly. Okay, so this all this stuff. Now here's the third part. What was the name of Judah's youngest? Shelah.
Shlomo, wow.
Adam.
Wow.
See that? Shelah and Shlomo. Isn't that interesting? All right. Is this all a coincidence?
It's an ingenious people.
Again, it's just interesting. And of course, the question is here too. Did David do all of that? I mean, what happened is, you know, it's possible that a king can do these things. And it shows that side of David, which is impulsive, which is, you know, values out the window. He could be an impulsive, plotting, you know, guy. He manipulated the Philistines twice. Okay.
So who has a worse opinion of all of these Jewish heroes, Jews or anti-Semites?
Bible.
So two things. If I remember, King David didn't just send Uriah the Hittite to the front lines. He directed his general to pull back and leave Uriah isolated.
could be. I don't remember the exact wording. Could be.
Yeah, and I happen to be, as a Michal supporter, think he behaved immorally with Michal before he behaved immorally with Bathsheba.
In what regard?
Number one, he just used her as an implement because she was Saul's daughter, and then later didn't. But this might have been after Bathsheba. I would have to look it up. When she later found happiness, presumably they were divorced. With she married somebody else. When David just wanted her as a symbol, he took her back, and the husband followed her crying. Or is that Mizrash? Now I'll have to look, but I don't think he treated Michal well. I mean, he treated Abigail well because Abigail, he listened to Abigail like a counselor, like a whatever. Not that they did well by Abigail's spouse either, but Michal was just a total implement.
Yeah. No, and in many ways, she was more sensitive and sensible about how things were to be than he was. Remember, she's the one that castigates him when he runs half naked after following the ark when the ark is brought into Jerusalem. And she says, you didn't act like a king, you made a fool of yourself. And he says, I don't care. I'm showing my commitment to God. Okay. But she, looking at it from the perspective of how a king should operate, but the difference is, you're right. He acted inappropriately with her. I no question about it. But nothing he did was technically against law or against, we'd say halacha. He didn't violate Torah. Because very often women at that time could be viewed as being, secondary. You know, their job was to follow the will of the husband, especially if the husband's the king. So she was a tough cookie, and I agree with you. She's right in many instances, but it's not the same as what David did with respect to being an adulterer and a murderer. That's the point. Tybalt.
I found the name. I looked quickly because I was already in the right book. Michal, presumably David divorced her. It says. Chapter 25, verse 44. Now Saul had given Michal his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was of Galim. And then later, David, when he wants to make the point that he's got in his household King Saul's descent and his own scent, takes her back.
Okay. All right. But the point is, that's nasty. That whole thing. But again, it's not the same. It's not of the same level of a crime. Bad, he's not being very nice. Okay, but he didn't break any laws with respect to the rape, the seduction, the act. And the death of the husband, Uriah. And then Nathan places into him and says, this is, you're going to have big payback on this. And what was the payback? Who died?
The firstborn from Bathsheba.
Exactly, the firstborn. So he also suffered the death of a child. So Jacob suffered the death of two sons. I mean, the grandsons, right? Two grandsons. Judah suffered the death of two sons. And David suffered the death of a son. That's another connector. So anyway, my assumption is these are not accidents. Somewhere, something, somehow, stories are being defined in a way that shows a similarity and shows that ultimately the two powerful named people are human beings. Okay, first, Bert, then Mark.
Quick question. Okay, I'm convinced. I buy it. Why? And not why do I buy it, but what are the theories as to why these are connected?
All right. I was just moving in that direction.
Okay, then I shall wait.
So you have the Mark, hold on. I saw your hand. Yeah. You have, and that's why it puzzles me. I would consider the stories of Jacob what I call the mythic accounts of the patriarchs and matriarchs. Myth in the sense that these are stories that were carried down through generations, right? About people who were associated with the clan. And that's a perfectly normal thing, right? That you remember your founding fathers and mothers and stories about them. The question is, over time we know stories are additional elements become added to them. Different generations seek different ways of understanding what their parents were doing. Okay? And there were no necessary, we don't know if any, are these things written down? We don't know. At a certain point, clearly they were written down. But we don't know exactly when that was. And most of these stories are within the traditions, the time frame that has been designated by scholars based upon language and style, right use of words, ideas that exist, and so forth. There are elements in the stories of the patriarchs and matriarchs that we know are ancient. The notion of the wife-sister concept, they found parallels to that in ancient Mesopotamian documents. The names in this third millennium BCE find of what apparently were students learning how to write. They found names, okay? Proto-Semitic names that are very similar. There's an Avram. I think there's a Yaakov. The names like those guys that were there. So they know that there's a history to these names going way back. So there are elements in these stories that undoubtedly you can say this makes sense. But again, it's hard to know. Now, with respect to David, one thing we do know is that there were court records that were kept. Okay? And so we know that there are elements of solid history in the books of Samuel and Kings, right? There are names of kings from other nations around, and they have found archaeological evidence that those guys really existed. Okay? And they found a stone from the mid ninth century that definitely refers to Israel. And, you know, there's an argument, but most people believe, yes, that there's a reference in there to Beit David. Okay? So, and then, again, within these stories themselves, there's other things that fit into what they know about how monarchies and various things operated during biblical times. But on the other hand, we also know that even those documents were massaged. Okay? History was not written back then the way it is supposed to be written today. And that was the concept of objective, show me the facts, history is something that is still being refined. But a serious historians today who take, you know, who cite their sources, that's why it's so important to cite sources, right? And to analyze things that others can analyze, and they're subject to peer review, right? And if people who are reading those articles and books say this is BS, they will be, you know, the author will be told BS.
So right? You're saying no footnotes in Torah?
Exactly.
No bibliography at the back.
Exactly. So,
but there is one. But you are saying, but there is one. I mean, there.
No, no. The point is the footnoting. You can start doing footnoting as you move deeper and deeper into the biblical, later and later in the biblical period. So you don't know. Okay, you don't know. So the point is it can one say? And again, the issue, the one who has the real issue in all of this, is the Davidic dynasty, because it was controversial. Right? Not only was it controversial by virtue of the founding father, David, who was apparently a problematic character, which would justify a reason why they would try to show that all those problems existed in the person of Jacob. And this is the nature of things. This is the nature of people. Okay, so therefore they're sort of trying to justify him by showing he's no better or no worse than Jacob. And we all revere Jacob. This is how kings operate. These are how leaders operate. They're human beings, right? They're human beings. And so we can't expect them to do otherwise. So cut David some slack. Yeah, he could be a you-know-what. But on the other hand, he was the guy who really brought Yahweh worship heavy into Israelite life. He was the one who made sure that the ark was brought into the city
where
the temple would be built. Okay, sometimes he doesn't, and clearly the problem is he doesn't always follow what Yahweh presumably told him or what was in the codes. Now, one could argue historically, a lot of that codification hadn't taken place yet. And so the law was flexible. And you can't hold them on them. But some of the stuff is just plain common sense. Adultery is adultery is adultery. Right? And, you know, that's a basic principle in law. And, you know, murder, killing someone, like the way he did with Uriah. Nobody can justify that. I mean, no decent society could justify that. That's why I'm saying those things probably happened. And there was no parallel for that with Jacob. So, and another thing, I see your hand, Mark. I just want to finish.
Okay.
And you got to keep in mind that Judah and Israel, the two tribes, there was no love lost between them for periods of time. They would even wage war against each other. They would make covenants with other nations in the area against each other. Read the Book of Kings, which is remember, the Book of Kings is strongly Judah-oriented, even though it does mention the bad stuff. Chronicles is only Judah-oriented, by the way. You read the Book of Chronicles, you wouldn't even know that the Israelite kingdom existed. And the Israelite kingdom was the dominant kingdom. That's the point. The non-Davidic kingdom, the kingdom that looked down their noses at the Davidic line because it was this little pea, this little weak little thing in the south, right? I mean, that's a reality. We know that. Just in terms of the listing of nations, the activity, all this stuff. The south begins to become more active after the north falls. So, I mean, who's writing the history? What are the sources that are feeding into this? What was the influence of the northern view on the south when those people came south after the fall of the north? We know there's a lot of northern tradition that's woven into the Deuteronomic traditions, which were written in the south. Okay? And it may be that there were people in the south who looked around at the Davidic kings of their time. Hezekiah and Josiah notwithstanding. But remember, Menasseh, who ruled for 55 years, was a miserable king in terms of his following the word of God. Powerful. I mean, he made connections with all kinds of people. He was acting like a powerful king, and he would sacrifice children.
Oh, yeah.
55 years he ruled. Now, what does that do to your feeling, your sense about the value of this monarchy? And then you have Josiah comes and he's a saint. But the guys who come after him are, again, corrupt. They don't clean out the pagans. They don't continue Josiah's war against idolatry. No. And so that's when Jeremiah and Ezekiel come forward and say, these guys, look, this country's going to hell. So there's enough reasons to understand that there's going to be a lot of negative input regarding the Davidic kingdom. And so there are people who want to try to sort of whitewash it or at least contextualize it by saying, but it's really like Jacob. What do you expect? So the point is that I think if you can understand it that way, then the tendency would be to say that the stories of the, either they were able to pluck details out of Jacob's life that were traditional, that were passed down. Some of these real intrigues, just to demonstrate that, because they were family stories, and they put them together. You know, they made us aware as we read the Bible that there are similarities here to justify David, or that in fact, what it was the opposite, that the issues that they confronted with David at that generation, they went back to the other stories and refined them and plugged into Jacob certain negative tendencies to justify the king. I can't answer that. Nobody knows for sure. The tendency is to say the Jacob traditions are more ancient, the David traditions are later. One once assumed that the later traditions were modified to look more like the earlier ones. Okay, but I'm arguing there's a possibility it's the other way around, right? That they actually modified the earlier ones to make them look more similar to the ones here. And the other element to keep in mind is the following. Why does the Bible, in general, show all the warts of these kings? Okay, they do. I mean, the book of Jeremiah, the book of Kings, mm-hmm. right? It's always, there are kings that did right in God's eyes. They were good kings, but always says, but they didn't close down the Bamot. They didn't shut down the local shrines. So they were tainted. It may be that this negativity that developed with respect to the Davidic kingdom came from within these later records, that they were actually modified in order to indicate, to show that there were good kings, but they were flawed kings. And their concern was kick out the idols, kick, and that became the overriding thought. Get rid of the idols. Look what happened because of the idols. Two kingdoms fell. Get rid of them. It's bad. And it's been a stain on our system since the days that Rachel sat on the truffing. Okay? And it's an attempt to indicate the horror, the stink of idolatry. And that's the bottom line. And these critiques, in other words, they're Judeans, they're Judah people, possibly the new priesthood. Okay, the new priesthood. I want to remind you that there were priests involved with the Deuteronomic traditions. I told you this before, yes? Remember?
Mm-hmm.
You have Yehiel, who's the high priest who found the text that he gave to Josiah, right? He's a priest. Jeremiah was a priest. Ezekiel was a priest. And Ezra was a priest. And all of these guys had notions, clear notions, of what the problem was. And what was the problem? Idolatry, paganism. So the whole later all the later generations were concerned about that. And it may be that they were the ones that plugged all this stuff in. Maybe they wrote the story about Rachel and Michal using Trafim. Maybe they wrote them both. Maybe all of this modification of maybe this whole thing was written by those guys late in order to show the continuity of the issue. Maybe that's why it shows that even Jacob did some things that were wrong. He built a matseva, right? Poured oil on it, right? We talked about that, right? That's a bad thing. So it's there to indicate even those guys were doing those bad things. And then the golden calf, my God. You know, I mean, and so they're saying this has been a centuries-old problem. And even the monarchy was at fault consistently. And that's why the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom fell. We suffered because of their sins. We got to stop this. And that's it. Okay? And that was the governing principle. That's my thought. There's one other element that we want to throw in here, perhaps. That the notion of deification of monarchs is mentioned sometimes. Clearly, in Egypt, we talked about this. There's no question that the pharaohs were deified after they died. And that could be the reason why Moses' burial place, nobody knows. Because there's no place to go to worship him. And there's no family. There's no dynasty. It ends, period. So don't even think that Moses was God. Even though there's some tendencies in the stories. Remember, who do they blame for the Exodus when they're suffering in the desert? Moses. Why did you take us out of Egypt? Moses and Aaron sometimes. All right? All right. But the point is, but the kings, question is, could there be an attempt to try to make sure that nobody says the kings are gods or will be gods? No worship of kings. All right, so that's an Egyptian imported, and we know that the Egyptians had an impact on Israelite culture. There's no question, because they ruled that part of the world up until the time they ruled powerfully, up until the time of when the Philistines came in, and then afterwards, David kicked out the Philistines, basically sent them back where they belong on the coast. But then you have Shoshan comes in after Solomon dies, and he's an Egyptian king, and wants to take over the country again. Apparently, it didn't work that well. Then they pulled back and they stopped worrying about the bridge between north and south there. Okay, so they left that alone. But their influence was there, there's no question. It could be that that concept existed, but it's on the side. Generally speaking, Mesopotamian monarchs were not deified. They were not deified. It wasn't their traditions. And there's no clear indications that kings were deified in the Bible. Nobody raises that point. But the issue of the idols, all the time. The issue of paganism. That rampant disease, even good kings, right? That's why Hezekiah and Josiah are seen as the great hero kings, because they clean stuff out of the temple. It says so, right? It says so. We talked about that. So that could be the issue. It was this fanatical commitment to monotheism, and it shaped everything. All right. Bert.
Okay. I've heard everything you said. It makes a lot of sense to me. I'm still struggling with where is God in all this? I don't mean in the people's minds, but I came from a very secular household where Torah was just a book like any other. And I went to Hebrew school in a Reformed synagogue. And they told me the Torah was written by people, but it was divinely inspired.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Orthodox would tell you that Moses, God dictated the whole thing to Moses. You know,
Torah, the whole Torah.
The whole Torah. And we even, when we lift the Torah, we say this is what was spoken and given.
Sure.
And so I'm wondering, are you distinguishing between the later books, the historical books, and the Pentateuch, the five books of Torah, or how do we avoid this just being a bunch of folk tales?
Look, that's your faith. Okay, I'm a firm believer in the divine origin of the powerful traditions that are found in the Bible. Okay, that's a leap of faith with me. I believe that there are people, and there continue to be people who understand deep thoughts, and it's a special gift. And sometimes they are not recognized as such in their own generations, right? Famous line of prophets not recognized in his own home, you know, that whole thing. And there's no question that there were prophets who existed during the biblical period. There are references to them in a number of the biblical books. We have no idea what they wrote, what they taught, where they came down on all this stuff. We only have the words of the winners, not the losers, right? So, but yeah, but that's an article of faith. And when I think about these huge, these groundbreaking principles that you hear for the first time in our Torah, radically different from, you know, I don't care when they evolve, but they're there, okay? And I mean, the notion of equal in the law, in the eyes of the law, right? Equal in the eyes of, which is clearly set forth in an ancient law code in Exodus, right? The earliest law code. Okay. And that's at the same time, and we're seeing names of people. Yes, thank you. All these wonderful women, exactly, who were very active in this stuff.
That's the seven female prophets, according to the Talmud. Gee, what a surprise that I have that in my easy virtual background. Yes. Grab it.
Thank you. Yes, of course. Anyway, so the point is that these kinds of laws are rare. They're breakthroughs, and there's lots of them. The whole concept of Kedusha, of being accessible to people. That's what the one of the priestly traditions, the holiness code, says. The priests are not the only ones who can seek holiness. The people can. Kedoshim tihi you. You be holy because I, God, am holy. It does not aim at the priests. It's aimed at the people. That's an amazing statement, that each individual can be a seeker of holiness. That's great. All right. So, and the, where that ends up in rabbinic traditions, you know, broad universal principles, which are found in spite of there is always negativity toward the outside world, because that's the vestige of the push against paganism. And as we know, idolatry continued to operate down into the Middle Ages in places where the Jews were. I mean, you have this Gnosticism, which is not really idolatry, but it basically believes in a duality of powers between good and bad. Okay, that's pagan thinking. It's not pure monotheism. That pops up in Europe in the middle of the 12th, 13th centuries. All right. So the point is, we've always been faced with that. So that's a bad thing that continues to exist. But the fact is, my leap of faith is that there is this powerful force that exists in the universe, that sensitive people who have been blessed with God with a certain sensitivity can pick up on, and teach, and elaborate upon, and pass on. And that's why the Torah is the word of God.
So you would say it's God speaking through people.
Through people.
Very simply.
Yes, right.
Oversimplify.
people who, whether it, God appoints it that way or just the way he created the system, right? The way he created the system was to have that develop in people. How, where it pops up, that's free will based upon the, you know, who marries whom. But it's there, and the potential's there, and it always manifests itself. Question is, will everybody else appreciate it and listen to it? It's not science, what I'm saying. That's my leap of faith. Okay, Mark.
Yeah, years ago at UCLA, I took a graduate seminar in political theory with David Rappaport, and it was specifically dealing with these biblical issues through the lens of political concepts like legitimacy, authority, conditionality versus unconditionality of the kingship, mm-hmm. and use of power. So, you know, all this literature is basically a quest for legitimacy from, you know, a dynasty, you know, looking backwards. And King David's time was modern compared to Jacob's time, you know, in terms of his, of a historical timeline. But the fundamental problem was the conditionality of the kingship within the context of the developing religion. And the kings looked to other areas like Egypt and Mesopotamia to as inspirations for absolute power, but the whole structure with the prophets would not allow absolute power. It was not unconditional. It was conditional and therefore fraught with contradictions and conflict as far as extending a dynasty. You know, well, dynasties were hard to maintain.
Right. Exactly. It's a good point. And the same thing, then you had the priesthood also. At different times, it gains tremendous power. Other times, it's really secondary to the king. But the kahuna, I'm witness what I just said before about the priests who were very influential in shaping the later, in how the later traditions became formulated. And that's what we are heir to, right? That priestly imprimatur on the generations of the late 7th, 6th, and 5th centuries, as all of this biblical stuff is being refined and categorized and organized, right? That's when the bulk of that happens. The hand of the priests is seemingly present. And so that's another factor. And this is post, a lot of this is post-kings. Right, where somebody, and we know for a fact that in the Second Temple times, most of the time, probably okay, but the priests were the dominant, the high priest ran the country. The high priest ran the country. Witness the Jewish, we talked about this, the Jewish community in Elephantine, when they had Cyrus. Who'd they write to? The high priest. Help. There was no king, right? They didn't write to the Persian overlord at the time. They wrote to the priest because he could legitimately be in touch with the Persian government because they were there as the foundation of Jerusalem under the Persians was it's a city of religion. It is a priestly place. And that's the reason why they allowed them to rebuild the temple. It's a temple city, and that's part of, because that makes our God friendly with their God. Everybody's happy, right? Okay, that was how the Persians viewed it. All right, so you cannot deny the role of the priesthood, and even earlier on, we don't know for sure, but the priests undoubtedly. I mean, the book of look at the priestly law codes. Elements of them are late, but elements in them are early. So there's always been, it's not just the prophets. Cannot discount the priests. Sometimes they became corrupted, there's no question. They're humans like everybody else. And that's the bottom line again. Everybody's a human being. Bottom line. The rabbis put it this way. We're humans, we have a Yetzer Hara, right? We have an inclination toward evil. the rabbis articulated clearly. What's the solution? Torah, in its broadest sense, because Torah reinforces the inclination for good, which we also have. Okay? And that's why, midrashically, when it talks about the forming of the human being in the second chapter of Genesis, it says, Vayitzer, two yuds. Yitzer is the verb, right? And he shaped. Why two yuds? Well, that's grammatically correct. One is the yud from the shorish, from the root, and one is the yud to indicate, you know, the above yud indicating the time, right, when it happened, past tense. All right, but the point is, why two yuds? Yetzer HaTov and Yetzer HaRa. God built into us both inclinations. So that's why we need Torah. Okay? So as a recognition of the fact that we need law in order to control our tendencies. And that's sort of implicit in the Bible. And the rabbis express it very explicitly that way. All right? So there are a number of factors that play into it. The priestly voice is definitely, you know, that's sort of, I mean, Rappaport's, he's a Jewish guy, probably. But generally speaking, that is something that is, that prophet focus is something that came out of the Protestant Bible scholars like Wellhausen in the 19th century. And that's the explanation for all these crazy laws and this rigidity. Okay, but the fact of the matter is, the priests were also important in transmitting values, and it wasn't the prophets were not the only. The prophets were great because, from the Christian perspective, because the prophets were the ones they plumbed the prophets. The Christian scholars in antiquity plumbed the prophets in order to find the foreshadowings of Jesus, not the priests, and that bias existed. For decades, suddenly in the last 40, 50 years, suddenly the priests are now appearing. Jacob Milgren did a lot to bring this back. The priests are now seen as conveying within their laws ethical principles. You can read through the priestly law codes. There are ethical principles behind a lot of the stuff that seems to be arcane and archaic. So you cannot discount the priestly factor along with the prophetic factor. Okay. Wow, that was a long lecture, wasn't it? Okay. Tybalt, you have a comment?
Yeah, it was a while ago, but since you asked, I'll say it anyway. I was reminded when Mark was talking about power and authority and things like that, of an early teacher of mine who made me see Pirkei Avos differently, where he discussed the beginning of Pirkei Avos with the who's handing it down to be seen as the preamble for all of Talmud. Basically, the rabbi saying this is where our authority comes from, as opposed to seeing Pirkei Avos as the standalone, you know, the one Mishnah without Gemara. Instead, yes, it's the preamble to the whole thing.
Yes. Well, that's the preamble. It is. It's the preamble to the oral law. Right? And you notice who's missing in that. Moshe Kibel Torah Misinei V'Sarah Yoshua, Yeshua Lezkenim to the, you know, Nevi'im, whatever, and so forth and so on. It goes down the line. Who's missing?
Well, there's no David because it's the rabbis.
There's no king and there's no priest. They don't exist. It is, in a sense, a biased explanation. It skips over these guys. Okay? And that is probably because when that was written, there was no monarchy and there was no temple. And the priests had become a bugaboo for the rabbis. They were a pain in the butt because the rabbis wanted to. The priests came, and that's their perspective, as we've talked about. There's a certain rigidity to the Kohanim. They're accountants, right? They see everything with numbers and details. And that's why their recording of things and their statement of things sometimes can be very accurate, right? That's why they say, you know, well, look at the flood story. right, compare the J tradition to the P tradition. In the something day of, the something month, in the something year, to the, you know, life of Noah, whatever, blah, blah, blah. The priests write that way. But the flip side of it is that they're rigid. Okay, it's like the RCC today in Los Angeles with Kashrut. Rigid. No compromise. Our way or the highway. All right? That's so, and that's the, I'll say it, corrupt, ultra-Orthodox control that they have over things. Only glot meat. No regular kosher. Only glot, blah, blah, blah. Okay? All right, that's an obnoxious type of a thing. And the rabbis had to deal with that eventually because there was a power vacuum because there was no temple and the transmission of the priesthood became a theoretical and a messianic thing, not a real one. So they moved away from it. And that's why they're not mentioned. And the same thing with monarchy. You can't build a king, a monarchy, a dynasty into the active law because they're not there. And when will the dynasty be repeated? When will it come back? Is it something? Does traditional Judaism view the return of priests and kings as a desideratum? Yes or no?
Rambam would say no. Is that traditional enough?
No, Rambam, what are you talking about? Rambam...
He doesn't want sacrifices again. Doesn't that mean no?
No, that's not true. He has... the law code deals with those things. He legislates for a temple. And you're right. He's not... because he expresses all of that as messianic. He talks about laws for a king. You know that. He talks about laws for a king because that's messianic. He even though people challenged him on that, or people thought he was a he believed in the days of the Messiah, but it's something that's in the future. That's something that depends on the will of God. It's like the creation of the world. It's built into the system, and when the system is ready to activate it, it'll happen. It's there, but it just hasn't. It's not ready to activate. Okay? I mean, so the point is, Rabbinic Judaism, we pray constantly for the rebuilding of the temple. We pray constantly, looking at in the Amidah, right? Rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild the temple, give us back David, the monarchy. It's in our Amidah. We say three times every day. That's the Rabbinic perspective. It'll happen. When God.
And that's a Musaf. That's Musaf also.
Of course. Tybel.
Yes, but at least, and it may be, you know, here we are recorded. I'll quote Avraham Imfeld on his father. I'm an atheist, Baruch Hashem. I always thought that those were not seen literally, at least in the conservative movement, all that rebuilding, that it was metaphoric.
We don't ask for the rebuilding. We mention it, but we put most of that stuff in past tense.
Yeah, so it's...
We talk about the rebuilding of Jerusalem. There is mention made of the Bayit, yes. Yes, that's a metaphor, yes. But the actual implementation of sacrifices is something, if you read closely, it's all in a negative wording because we are not really... We recognize it as an aspiration of sorts. But to us, it's a metaphoric aspiration. And we are not, and when we say, you know, in the Amidah, right? At Tzemach David Meherat Tatzmiach and all this stuff, right? When we pray for that, okay, we do. But what we understand it is Yemot HaMashiach, which is a messianic era. So yet, from a conservative movement perspective, it's metaphoric and past. But in the Orthodox, in the traditional versions, it's future hope. It's an aspiration. Yes, there are tendencies. Look, Chabad will say the Mashiach is already here.
Oh.
He's here. He's just resting. Okay? The extremists.
Hibernating.
Coming back. Look, I saw this in Manhattan a number of months ago. We were walking in Manhattan. And there were signs on the light posts, right? He's here. No, he'll be here soon. Whose face was on it? The Rebbe. He'll be here soon. He's on his way. I'm not kidding.
A number of years ago, they were selling pagers.
Yes.
That you were supposed to carry, and it would go off when the Mashiach arrived.
Right, and there were kids walking around with you know, on kippot. Blessed be our king, our Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Yeah. I mean, you know, it said so, written out on the kippah. And here in Pico Robertson, there was one shul there, which for a week or two had the messianic flag on it, right? The crown of the Mashiach. Okay, it went down, I think, because it was right across the street from the big you know, the school on Pico. There's a Hasidic shul on the other side of the street, a Chabad affiliated shul. They had the flag up, and then it came down somehow. Somebody took it down. All right. So the point is, the answer is that traditional Judaism still believes that there will come a time when there will be a restoration of the priesthood, a restoration of the monarchy. But this will be in a golden age where everybody will be loving and wonderful and follow all the laws, and there will be peace and harmony, and it'll be beautiful. And it presumes a complete change in the nature of the human being, because human beings don't work that way. That's the other thing the Bible tells us. We are human beings, all of us. We have strengths. We have weaknesses. We can do wonderful things, and we can screw up. Now, that's what the Bible is. It does not whitewash. That's the good thing about all this stuff. Okay. Mark.
Yeah, here's a quandary that a lawyer friend who had to go for a bar refresher course told me about yesterday, and wondering what the Jewish view would be on. In terms of contracts, there was a case whether an emoji could establish a contract that had been negotiated in writing. And the last consent from one of the parties was a thumbs up as an emoji. So would that constitute the finality or connection of establishing a contract in Jewish law? You know, just a
I'm not
a symbol like that?
Of those things. What I do know is this, however, truthfully, the Jews in the Middle Ages who were involved in money lending had contracts that they would have the, let's say, a local knight who owned property wanted to buy a plow, and he didn't have the cash on hand. He needed to grow expand the crops on his territory, on his property. So he would go to a Jewish money and say, can I borrow blah, blah, blah? You know, they said, yes, you may. The interest rate is this and such and such. And the payout is 6 months, because they didn't have multi-year stuff like we had. They didn't have, you know, 30-year mortgages and stuff like that. So that was standard business in the 12th, 13th, even into the 14th centuries in certain places in Northern Europe. Okay? All right. What could the knights read and write?
Oh, you mean they made an X? So
yes.
It was like,
yes.
So there was their
now,
version
but,
of an emoji.
The point is, this was Dina da Malchuta Dina. Okay, this was law as far as the local government, because it had to pass muster in the local courts. It was done under the aegis of the royal courts or the bishop's court or whatever. The government, the Christian government, that they were the law. And it had to agree with their standards. And those things were legal documents. Now, whether they, how that viewed halakha, you know, the under the principle of Dina da Malchuta Dina, We would accept that if we assume, if we can validate that the ruling government is basically ethical. So if I'm comfortable that the king or the prince or the duke or the baron, whoever, is the guy with whom, who gives my town the charter to operate according to Jewish law and so forth and so on, right? Which they would, these charters said you can have your own courts, this and that and the other thing, but you got to pay me so much in taxes and your interest rate should be such and such and such and such, whatever. Okay? So, Dina da Malchuta Dina, it's the law for the Jews as well. So yes, the guy made an X.
And that was sufficient for the contra. Interesting. I got to tell my friend about that. So
yeah,
it's
but
a
that's one case. I'm saying there are people who are much more, who know the history of these things. You got to talk to a Jewish historian who knows a history in detail of Jewish legal and economic practices. Mm. I was more into the intellectual history side. But because I taught, you know, I had to deal with these issues, I, you know, had to, you know, deal with the documents and explain them to students or use them to explain what was going on. But yeah, that's legit. That was legit. Under the principle of Dina da Malchuta Dina, on the other hand, if the Jewish government, whomever they were, viewed the overlord as being corrupt and bad, then Jews would not necessarily internally accept documents that were signed under the aegis of the local law, because they said, we don't accept that. You know, we're moving away from that. They had to do it sub rosa because they could be punished.
But they were, how about?
I have read Tosafot, where they explicitly say that a Jew cannot buy land that used to be owned by a Jew that was taken away illegally by the overlord and buy that land back.
And really? Wow.
They have to allow the original family to do that. You cannot step in for them, even though that's what the law was. And so there were people who would take that to the Christian, to the local court and say, these folks are not allowing me to exercise my rights under your law. And either they would stand with the Jewish court and say, sorry, you got to listen to your own people on this because that's the mandate and we want that mandate to continue. Or they would say, fine, we'll take care of those Jews. And that's how certain elements of the weakening of that whole system began to happen in like the late 13th century. And we have documents about Jews who were arguing one way or the other, you know, and it was not an easy thing to deal with.
And in cases where Jews were making contracts with other Jews, would a ex suffice?
And I don't know.
Probably so, wouldn't you think?
May I chime in and ask you, Rabbi, because that's what my hand was up. When Jews make contracts with other Jews about most things, including a ksuba, there needs to be a kinyan. So the emoji wouldn't be enough because there's no kinyan.
Yeah, but the kinyan would be included in that.
Well, if it's an item you can lift, you're supposed to lift it and move it. If it's a house, you're supposed to do this. If all it is an emoji, that's no kinyan.
Right. Well, the question, though, is at what point did the... Yeah, but if you're making an agreement with a non-Jew, you don't have to have kinyan.
Oh, I know. My point was when Mark was saying that, when Dina Malchuta Dina does not apply because it's Jew to Jew, and then Mark added that. So I thought I'd ask you the question about kinyan.
Internally, my understanding is you need the signature and the kinyan. Think of a ketubah today. Okay, that's going to come. And I don't know. The question I cannot answer is, at what time was the use of a signature? We know, for example, that already in biblical times, a ring with a medallion on it could be used on wax as a signature.
Hmm.
That's biblical. I mean, that's something that...
Is it- To go back to our class, what Judah gave to Mar was so important, because wasn't it his signet ring that he could have used to make contracts?
That was his signet, exactly. Yeah, that's right. So that identified him. Exactly. Good point. Yeah, because that was clearly his. So those were used at, you know, I don't know if they could sign their names or not. All right. And these now poorer people clearly did not all have signets all the time. So what they did was, it may be that they made a mark. Okay. I do not know enough about that. You know what? Mark, send me an email.
Okay.
What about signatures in past centuries? Jewish signatures. Let me see what I can find, because I want to learn that. Or I could say to you, Mark, work. What do you prefer?
Say it again.
Mark, want to know about signatures? Get something ready for next week.
Okay.
That's our last class. By the way, next week's our last class until after Pesach.
The emoji in question was the thumbs up.
I know which one. I'm just asking. We're talking. There it is, guys. Okay. All right. No, I'm saying, but that would be in lieu of a formal signature, right? Mm-hmm. So the question is, it's making a mark. Okay. So forget about the electronics versus on a piece of paper for a moment. And because today electronics, you know, is accepted widely. And that's a very contemporary thing. But just in general, the history of the signature in Jewish law.
Okay. So I'll send you an email to check it out?
Or you can check it out.
Okay.
Do you have time?
Yeah. Maybe a good start would be.
Google that. Google it. Okay. Rav, the Googler Rav knows a lot.
Googler Rav.
Yes, the Googler Rav is a very smart guy. Sometimes he's forgetful. Sometimes he gets confused. But very often, you know, when it's straightforward information and citation and so forth, a good article from the Google Rabbi is helpful.
Does he have artificial intelligence behind him?
He sent that off to the big Beit Din for them to make a ruling.
He's still waiting for the ruling.
You know, it's a complicated issue. It may take a couple of decades, but
not with supercomputers. The Beijing has artificial.
Yeah, when they get hold of it, they're going to ask so many. But what about this? Wait a second. What about that? No, but it says this over here.
That'll take centuries.
I will.
And that just reminded me. There's a comedian called Elon Gold that has like a 4 or 5 minute bit about why it's a good thing that Jews don't have Christmas trees, because the halacha about how you cut it and when you string the lights and when you take the lights down and what kind of lights it will go on the top. It is.
Yeah, I know. Yes. I'm aware. I've seen that. The whole. Yes, exactly. That's very funny. All right. So next week is the end. We're going to finish this up. I think we've discussed the big question that Bert was, you know, raised. And I want to thank you on that, because in my own mind, I was clarifying certain things while I was talking to you, because I'm still awake enough. It's, you know, it's just, oh my God, what is it? 10 minutes to two. So I'm not yet sound asleep. You know, that'll hit me in the afternoon. I take a nap. But in the meantime, the brain is still sharp. So I was relatively clear, I think, in what I said. Complicated, but clear. But
it was a great presentation.
Okay. Great. Thank you. All right. So next week we shall end. And then I think we maybe talked about it already. I'm more than happy to resume sometime after Pesach.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am, Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.